Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
It is my honor to introduce E.G. Valianatos. He is very interesting. He's the author of this book, Poison Spring, as described, and he worked for the EPA, an insider, for 25 years. People trusted him. They gave him all sorts of documents that you would not be able to get today. He's also a former staff member of the Congressional Office of Technology Assessment and is a former legislative assistant to Representative Clarence Long. So with great pleasure, I introduce Dr. Valianatos.
Thank you very much. I'm grateful to be with you today, and of course I'm grateful to Dr. Susan Downs for making all this possible. And this is the first time in my life I'm speaking in this distinguished forum. So I'm very grateful for that, and I'm very pleased that you're all here today. As Susan said, I worked for the US EPA for 25 years, so in this kind of time, you accumulate a lot of some knowledge and documents and experience, and that's exactly what I'm going to be talking to you about this experience with the government for 25 years. And it's very relevant, really, the book I wrote and what we're going to be talking about, because as we speak, we have an administration in Washington, the Trump administration, that, as you might have already guessed, they pay zero attention to the environment. In fact, they're hostile to any kind of environmental protection in this country. And that, to me, is a blow against health and against civilization itself. So before I get into the real substance of what I'm going to be talking about, I will say a few things about myself so you can make up your own minds about what I'm going to be saying later on. I grew up in a Greek island, and I left the island in 1961. I came to the United States, and I went straight to the University of Illinois for a degree in zoology, BA. And then I dropped the idea of becoming a medical doctor. And I went to graduate school, and I got a master's in medieval Greek history. And then I left Illinois, and I went to Wisconsin, and I got a doctor's degree in Greek history. And from there, I went to Harvard on a postdoctoral opportunity where I studied the history of science. And that experience led me to eventually this, because that experience allowed me to write a book, my first book called Fear in the Countryside, where I went to the country of Colombia and Latin America, and I tried to understand what was the impact of the American technological system of agriculture in a country like Colombia that had different traditions. And the idea, the people who funded me, it was a big foundation. They were hoping that I was going to write a book in praise of the industrialized form of agriculture that we were actually passing on to Colombia. And regrettably for them and for, I reached the exact opposite conclusions, because this was done in the mid-70s, and in the mid-70s, the talk then, as it is today, is all about the so-called green revolution. That is, we have to industrialize everything, we have to discard the peasant traditions of agriculture because they are backward, and we have to accept and modify and work with tractors and pesticides and fertilizers and grow one corn here, one crop here, one there. In other words, we have to modify our ancient traditions of agriculture to what the agricultural people at the universities talk about, industrialized and modern agriculture. So when I went to Colombia, I discovered the exact opposite, that is that our knowledge, both scientific agricultural knowledge and the eventual application of it in the form of tractors, fertilizers, and so on, had the exact opposite effect. That is, it helped the very wealthy people that had already a hacienda to make it even larger. And the peasants that would lose their land because the prices would drop to zero almost, they would eventually abandon their land, and they would become the stream of migrants that end up in California, Arizona, and so on. And that tradition continues to this very day, unfortunately. And this is very bad because most of the world actually gets its food not from the industrialized agriculture. It gets from those peasants that we think they are backward. Industrialized agriculture all over the world produces no more than 30% of the total world food supply that we need. So that's the background. When I wrote my book, by the way, the very professor that supported me at Harvard while I was there, a junior fellow, he got very upset because the conclusions of my book, of course, were antithetical to what he hoped that I was going to reach. And he said, you know, this is not good. I said, Dr. Ravel, look at the footnotes. The book is very well documented. So that's how I started. So I started with a kind of ambivalent feeling about the whole idea of industrialization, the whole idea of modern science, that it's the only method of trying to discover the truth and so on. And since I was a historian with a lot of Greek background, you know, I'm starting today with something that you probably understand. This is from Hippocrates, the father of medicine. 2,500 years ago, this guy, this medical doctor, of the father of medicine, said, look, we cannot just pretend that we ignore the natural world. You have to understand the seasons. You have to understand what kind of water you drink, what kind of herb you breathe before you build a city, before you do all this. So this is very, very fundamental idea that is absolutely very vital to this very day. And then another, just this is the only other reference to antiquity, is from this wonderful surgeon and physician in Alexandria, 3rd century before Common Era, that is 2,300 years ago, who defined the health. He said, in the absence of health, all is lost. Wisdom takes a vacation. Science becomes obscure. Strength is problematic. Wealth is useless and reasoning impossible. Think of it, therefore, how important this idea of what we call health is. And then put that in context of what we're actually doing. And here I am starting out with the 1948. This is just a picture from the Donora smoke in Pennsylvania. It was a mill town, and something happened with the temperature, weather, winds, and all the pollution stayed down and killed about 20 people, but it was a devastating air pollution, and they still call it the worst in the United States. And from there, the next year, this is 1947, we have the DDT, and this is emblematic of everything I will actually speak about. This chemical was discovered in late 19th century. It was abandoned for several decades until a chemist from Switzerland put it in the form that we know as DDT, and it became the bestseller. Everybody was using it to kill bugs, to kill anything that they didn't want it to see. It's an organochlorine. It lasts for decades in the environment. And as you can see from the advertisement, what I'm telling you is irrelevant. I mean, they loved it. They thought this was a golden bullet to kill, to take care of everything. You even have this picture of this mother with a baby associated with the spraying of DDT. And so you can see that our society in 1947 was completely caught up by the post-World War II euphoria. You know, this country won the war in Europe, and they got back, and they said, now we are an empire, we are going to actually control the world. And this became a weapon of war, that is the control of the natural world. And you can see now how careless the people, both public authorities and farmers were. They thought DDT was completely innocent of all harm, so the children could just simply go through the fog and no problem. And the soldiers returning back from World War II, they were doused with the spray of DDT. This is the year of our Lord, 1979. This is the year I started working at EPA. So what did I do at EPA? I had a PhD in history, and I had some knowledge of the history of science. I was a good writer, relatively speaking. So they put me in a program that I could help biologists and economists with alternatives. And for the first year and a half or 2 years, everything went pretty much smoothly. The supervisor I had was a very understanding biologist. But then you know, but being there, you hear things on the corridors and you have lunch with people and so on. So what really turned me completely against what was going on was this idea of what had already taken place, that is the laboratories. We need laboratories to test these chemicals. The law says you cannot use a chemical like that because it goes into food and water unless the testing demonstrates that it does not cause unreasonable adverse effects on man, woman, and the environment. Well, I mean, how are you going to prove that? So among the laboratories that came up to do the testing, there was a laboratory outside of Chicago called Industrial Biotest. This was a gigantic laboratory because it tested up to 40% of all the chemicals in this country. So it became a gigantic laboratory, and they began to speed up the process. I mean, you pay them to do a two-year test. They did it in four months, and then the rest of the time, they make up the numbers. So they would publish a nice report, give it to the registrant that pay for the testing, and this chemical company would come to EPA and say, here, chemical X, this is the report. It does not cause any unreasonable adverse effects. Therefore, EPA would say you have permission now to begin to sell it, and that's what happens. But these people had faked the information for the approval of 40% of the chemicals in this country, including some of the best sellers and the biggest of the chemicals, including the DDT, the glyphosate of the Roundup, and all the other big ones, the DDE, 2,4,5-T, you name it. It had gone through that IBT laboratory. So the question was, after the information came out that they were faking the numbers, what to do about it? After all, if you're a legitimate government with some kind of ethical standards, once you discover this is a crime, right? It's a crime to do that. So you put the people in prison and you simply recall the chemical back. I mean, after all, it came to the market through a fraudulent means. You cannot allow it to be used by the farmers so that it ends up in your food and in the water and in the air that we breathe. But doing that, of course, would have put out of business a big chunk of the chemical industry. So this was the administration now of Jimmy Carter. This is the Democrat administration that I started. Jimmy Carter was in power. And I remember I was at a staff meeting in Washington. And there were several senior people, and one of them said, we just received orders from the White House that we are going to drop any idea of prosecuting any of the chemical industry companies, but focus on the laboratory only. Just try to shut it down if you have the evidence that you do. So they did. They did exactly that. This is 1980, and it took down to 83 to shut the laboratory down. After a very lengthy trial in Chicago, thousands of pages of testimony, and they prosecuted the president of the company, used to be a professor, listen to this, professor of medicine from Northwestern University, a very distinguished elite school. He had created this factory of faking data, made lots of money. He was considered a big philanthropist in Chicago. He hired black people. He had white people and so on. So everybody loved him. But guess what? His factory was a mess. I mean, I knew personally, and I got very close friend to the guy who actually made the discovery of the fraud, Adrian Gross. The man died in 1992, but he was a pathologist from FDA, and then he worked for the EPA for 10 years. And he and I were close friends, and my office and his office were very close, so we used to talk a lot. And very interesting, very honest guy, forthright. they made him a head of toxicology at EPA with the idea of reforming and making up to latest standards. And he tried to do that. But guess what? Within a year after he became a branch chief, they demoted him. Why? Because he caught his own toxicologist. I didn't say he caught his own toxicologist doing exactly what IBT had done. That is what happens. Let's say the government, the industry brings you a tome about 1,000 pages of data for a chemical. And you, in the government, that is the toxicologist, are supposed to examine, to look at the math, whether it makes sense to, because of their knowledge, to know whether the, what they have in front of them is legitimate or not. So instead of going through this 1,000 pages, they would go straight to the conclusion, pick up the conclusion of the chemical company and paraphrase it and put it in their own conclusion. And he discovered that, Adrian Gross discovered that. He said, no. You do that, they will fire you. But because of that, because he did that, they fired him. They demoted him. And they gave him, excuse me, they gave him a room, and he was doing nothing for about 10 years. I mean, I was next to him. And this is what happened. He called it cut and paste science. Cut and paste science from the industry to EPA. And then, of course, that false conclusion became the government conclusions in order to approve the chemicals. This is the kind of a racket. This is the kind of a fraud that really, really turned me off. Another big case that actually changed my mind, and I so they helped me to speak the way I do, was a brief but very vital experience in North Carolina. They sent me to a very detailed seminar where we had experts, and they talked to us about what happens when human beings are harvesting crops and then the airplanes over them spray the chemical. I mean, it's just a horror story. And they were using chemicals that some of which are related to chemical warfare agents. That is, they are called organophosphates. They are, you know, neurotoxins. They affect the central nervous system and the brain. And so when I got back after this, I wrote a lengthy memorandum with very well footnoted, documented. I did my historical research, and I went to World War II, and I saw what was going on. So I paraphrased all that, and I put it in a historical context, and I said, this is very inappropriate. I mean, we in the government, we should not be in a position to approve chemical warfare stuff in a modified version. I mean, I don't mean that they had chemical warfare going on, but I mean that these chemicals were very much siblings related to the original toxins that they used in World War I. And then they had piles of the stuff of World War II, but they never used them in World War II. And my supervisor, she said nothing. And she never talked to me again. this is what they do. They just simply ignore you. Once you they disagree with you fundamentally, they simply ignore you. And then they begin to think, how do we fire this guy? Whatever. But they couldn't fire me because everything I wrote was very well documented. So I didn't mean, it's nothing. So they are looking for other things to, for instance, with Adrian Gross, they thought the secretary charged him for sexual harassment, something to that effect. And of course, he said to me, never did I do anything. So anyway, they tried to find things that are relevant to get you out of the way. So between those, that experience, and then, you know, been there for 25 years, my colleagues, some of them liked me and I liked them, and some didn't, of course. Some thought that I was not a team player. And when they say that you're not a team player, you are beyond repair. Forget about the promotions or any other things. And so the idea of being there was, yes, I had the opportunity to learn a lot, and I did learn a lot, and I had plenty of time to do research, and I did a lot of research. But at the same time, I came face to face with this harsh reality. What do you do about it? So I began to leak information. I became a whistleblower. That is, I would take pertinent data, pertinent documents, and have luncheons with staff, key staff members of subcommittees, Democratic subcommittees. Since I had already worked for a congressman, I knew some of them. So they were talking to me and taking furiously notes and so on, and I was hoping they would get some investigation going on about the evidence on the papers that I was giving them. None, nothing. They did not. This is another major conclusion that in my experience, both the Democrats and the Republicans may disagree on a lot of things, but they agree on the deterioration of the environment. In other words, the chemical industry has literally purchased them almost. I mean, I don't know whether they get bribed, but at least they get a lot of support for being reelected, both the senators and the congressmen. So if the chemical industry comes up to something, they say yes. Like right now, for instance, with Trump. The Trump administration approved a chemical known as dicamba. It's a herbicide that volatilizes very fast. And it has caused trouble all over the United States. And in fact, farmers are pitting themselves against other farmers because this stuff immediately becomes gas and it kills tomatoes. It kills any other broadleaf plant that you have. And this is what he did. I mean, especially with the so-called deregulation. His first administrator, the other guy that replaced him, they followed the playbook of the Reagan administration. I remember the Reagan administration very well. So let me show you some of the slides from the Reagan administration so you see what I mean. When you spray these chemicals, by the way, this is the chemistry itself. These are very little of the amount that the airplane or the helicopter sprays ever reaches the insect or the weed that you want to, you're attacking. Most of it becomes volatile, becomes air gas, and then it sprays with the wind. It can land 10 miles, 20 miles away, and will come down with rain, fog, snow. So you really cannot control it after you release it. And look at the fellow on the he's running for his life. You see he's coming, the fog is coming over him. And so the land, these are pictures from the 80s, come from the state of Iowa. not much has changed in the country except the machines have become more complicated and larger. Here is a place that they are mixing the chemicals. At this moment, I want to make some remarks that are maybe technical, but at least they tell you something about the chemicals. When they have a chemical tested, that part that they test, they call it active ingredient. Now, let's assume that the testing is legal, perfectly normal, and so on, and it can be used. That active ingredient is never used alone. So they mix it with a number of other chemicals, which EPA, in this case, in this, it's stupid decision, they call those chemicals inerts. I-N-E-R-T-S, inerts, like water, drink. But some of those inerts, however, they happen to be more toxic than the active ingredients. So think of the cocktail that you spray, the farmer sprays. It has nothing to do, but very little to do with the original active ingredient. So now we are talking about glyphosate being the most popular chemical on Earth, on the planet Earth. That glyphosate is never used alone. It's used with a number of other things. They call them Roundup. No one tests Roundup that gets into your corn, into your soybeans, into your food. But they because of the history I gave on the testing and the power of the chemical industry, the chemical has become a global panacea. The farmers use it all over. They assume it's not carcinogen. Of course, it is a carcinogen and so on. And also the other danger is that the people that are doing the spraying, look at the picture here. No protection. I mean, they are just, they treat it like they think this is nothing. For instance, my case, 2 days ago, we have a swimming pool. We bought a house, but it had already a swimming pool. So a person comes from this little company, and they put some chlorine. And this young man came, and he broke the, with his bare hands. I said, hey, what are you doing? He said, what do you mean? I have been doing this. I said, no, this is chlorine. He said, what about chlorine? I said, it's a very toxic gas. In the form that you have it in a solid form, but it's a very toxic chemical. And I tried to give him some background about World War I and all this. Oh, he said, my God. I said, I promise I'm going to get gold gloves. So next time he came with gloves. So there is a lot of misinformation or not enough knowledge about these chemicals. And we assume they're not going to do any harm to us. And that's fundamentally the propaganda of the chemical industry. They want you to believe that this stuff is completely innocent, harmless. So here is a gigantic sprayer that you can see. When you have this kind of gigantic machinery working on petroleum, using petroleum, you need also a large large pieces of territory, right? Your land, your farm has to be large, hundreds of acres, maybe thousands of acres, and so on. So what happened to the idea of the 160-acre farm? That was the idea of post-Civil War in this country. The 40 acres and the new for the black farmer and so on. What happened to all these ideas? They are gone. Because the Department of Agriculture after World War II began to focus its energy only on very few large farmers. And now, as we speak, about $25 billion goes to those large, big farmers. Not to the small farmers, especially family farmers, or much less to the peasants or any other country. When I was teaching, before I retired in 2004, I was teaching at the University of Maryland. And I was and the University of Maryland is a land-grant university, meaning the land was given to them by the federal government to do agriculture. And the dictate then of the 1860s was, you're going to be paid, but you're going to use your knowledge, your science, to assist the small farmer, the family farmer, as we call them in this country. But no, unfortunately, those land-grant universities now have become subsidiaries of the big companies. In fact, I call them the brain of agribusiness. And they are the brain, because they have made a lot of inventions which have helped the chemical industry to invent new chemicals, new technologies, new machinery, larger machinery, more complicated machinery, in order to divorce people from the land. Fundamentally, that's what it is. You can be a farmer in this area. You can live in San Francisco. Your farm can be in the Central Valley. You deal with all these gadgets and you order, you do this. So it's become a kind of a computerized, a kind of a factory in the fields. It's no longer do you have boundaries. I mean, I have visited Central Valley. I have visited Coachella Valley. I have visited Imperial Valley. And I go there and I get dizzy. I don't know. I said, what is this? What is the land? You only see a flat area and nothing else. No people, no houses, no... I remember I grew up in a little village, after all. My father had only about 4 acres of land divided in strips of land. Here, there, small olive trees and grain vines and so on. And this is completely antithetical to the tradition I grew up. Here you have another gigantic farm. This guy is spraying. And, of course, the byproduct of that, some of the byproducts are trash. Mountains of trash. And I'm on the slides, I have a number of cartoons, of course, that exaggerate, but nevertheless, I hope you can get the spirit of this. Here, this is another very, very interesting report that I need to make a comment on this. Some of you probably remember Rachel Carson. She wrote that wonderful book, Silent Spring, in 1962. Unfortunately, she died in 64 for breast cancer. And she warned the country about DDT in particular, because DDT was having a big effect on birds. That's why the book is called Silent Spring. And she had some impact in the federal government. Kennedy was a president then. His secretary of agriculture was amenable to some of these ideas. At any rate, Kennedy was gone, and in 69, the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, as they call it then, produced this report. And among the findings of this, and by the way, this is the only report I have seen that combines health and the environment. So you can see the relationship of pesticides and the relationship to environmental health. If we had kept with that tradition to think to have pesticides and environmental health, we would not be having the problems we have today, but we have divorced them. We don't want to talk about pesticides and environmental health at the same time. In fact, very few people talk about environmental health. They talk about human health, but rarely about environmental health. So this is a big deal, for me at least, anyway. And among the many conclusions was this. Look at this. This is DDT. But he's talking about DDE. DDE happens to be a metabolite, which is the carcinogenic part of DDT. And look at the graph. The black ball is the blood, the amount of stuff of DDE that they find in the blood of people who are not whites. And look at the amount. It's almost double the amount of poison going into people. Because why? It's not because of skin color. It's because of the food that they ate or they eat. You eat stuff that is fatty, that bioaccumulates the poison. And then you do some rigorous exercise, you release into your blood, and you may be in deep trouble. So this is a fundamental conclusion that they reached in 1969. That's a long time ago. And yet this idea has completely disappeared from research. You wonder why. So the same thing, this is about the distribution in states. And you see the same results. And now we come to the administration of Mr. Reagan, who was from California. And I was in Alexandria, Virginia, but I was working in Washington, D.C., so I used to read the Washington Post. And I would cut off the cartoons that I liked, and I have put them here. Look at this. This is very interesting. You see, double barrel attack. you have a chemical lobby, and then the other one is chemical dumping. And the dumping is not significant. I remember hearing that after dark, you have trucks full of this stuff, and they go on a highway, and they begin to release it next to the highway. They caught people like that, and so it's almost the gangster kind of operations. And here is a kind of a cartoon about EPA. It says, Mr. Mortimer is working on a theory that could have a major impact on the future of the Earth. He thinks he has detected signs of intelligent life at the Environmental Protection Agency. It's kind of a tragic comment, but nevertheless, this is from the 80s. And of course, this is a key one that captures a lot of the anxiety and reality, that you have the Department of the Interior is a branch of the oil, timber, and mining industry. I mean, this is not too far from the first of the truth. And EPA is a branch of the chemical industry. And the Department of Defense is a branch of the arms manufacturing industry. So the cartoonist has the liberty to do things that we don't necessarily like to admit or even talk about it. And so there's an element of truth in all this. Within the EPA, of course, under the Reagan administration, it was quite an upheaval because some people lost their jobs, especially the people that had been just hired. And then the Mrs. Gorsuch, the first administrator of President Reagan, a lady from Colorado whose son is now the Supreme Court Justice, if you remember, the first thing she did, his mother, Mrs. Gorsuch, she's dead by now. Anyway, Mrs. Gorsuch, she fired all the lawyers responsible for the enforcement of the environmental laws at EPA. So if you do that, what message do you give to the industry, and what message do you give the rest of us? But that's a fact. So within the EPA, this cartoon shows you that this man or whatever is stepping on the Code of Federal Regulation, the laws. On the right, and this is another picture of the wreck that Mr. Reagan caused at EPA. And here's the lady I was talking to you about, Mrs. Gorsuch. She's like a police woman protecting the EPA is beyond fences. And he says, now would like to send an international Red Cross inspection team. And this is a letter from a lady in California complaining about the regulations of the activities of the Office of Pesticide Programs in Washington, D.C. Even the wildlife got very upset about all that. And here we have a farmer receiving a letter from the USDA about the farm chemicals. They want us to forget the BS they have been telling us for 40 years and go back to using manure. Isn't that wonderful? And then this one is another comment criticizing EPA. It says, now we need to invent another agency to protect us from the Environmental Protection Agency. And again, here, this is also to some degree true, that we have contaminated because they spray them. We have contaminated even the groundwater, and it says we don't bother buying pesticides anymore. We just spray the crops with our groundwater. It's an exaggeration, of course, but nevertheless, you get it.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Here is the one slide that actually is very much valid to this very day. We're talking about the revolving door, as it's known. On the left side, you have Monsanto and FDA. This is just an example of FDA. It's the Federal Drug Administration. It deals fundamentally with drugs. And Monsanto, of course, is a multinational global corporation that owns glyphosate or Roundup, and now is a subsidiary of a German company. At any rate, what the lesson of this is that, let's say, President Trump has appointed the political appointees within EPA, within FDA, within USDA. These political appointees, when they're there for 4 years, they deal with companies. Correct, or whether they are agricultural companies or whatever. And they know, you know, they're very well paid as we speak right now. But they also know that the drug companies or the pesticide companies pay much more. So while they decide on any issue, and they usually side with the company, they also communicate almost on an invisible manner that my next job will be with that company. And the executives of that company know exactly that, and they actually want them to go with them. So we have this legal system that allows the people from the industry to come to the government to do work for 4 years and then go back to the industry, knowing all the secrets the government had and all the contacts that they have had with the government. And that's why the industry pays them such tremendous salaries, because with that they get access. They really get access, because being a political appointee, you run, let's say, 600 people. They depend on you. So if you leave the post and you go to a chemical post and then you call them up later, they are ready to talk to you and give you anything that you want. So that's exactly what we do. This is informal lobbying, and this is the revolving door idea. So anybody who thinks of changing the system, they have to start by abolishing this revolving door. Say, anyone who works for the government on an executive position cannot work for the industry that he supposedly regulated for, let's say, 10 years. And by that time, you'd be dead. Nobody wants to talk to you after 10 years. And and here are the beneficiaries of all this pollution stuff and the irresponsible deregulatory policies that we have. These major corporations are making big money, and they care less. In other words, we have taken to the point that say we are civilized societies, so we're going to have laws, right? Laws regulating the quality of water, quality of food, how the farmer sprays and all this. But guess what? The people who have the power, the agribusiness or the chemical industry or the pharmaceutical companies, they control the show. They have the money. So we're going to ignore the law, but we're going to keep the law, but we ignore the law. Just like Mrs. Gorsuch, she fired the lawyers who would be enforcing the law. So no enforcement, that means it's as if you don't have any law. Because the polluters know whether you enforce the law or not. And this is another similar slide. It tells you exactly what's going on. On the left, you have the policeman who is talking to the executives, let's say. They will keep pumping the stuff in the water. And he says, no, stop. But they keep pumping it. What does that tell you? That they ignore the government, ignore the law and so on. And this young man, he wants to go for swimming, and suddenly, no. Can go. It's another illustration of the Acme Chemical, Acme Cancer, Acme Hospital. It's all in the family. It's kind of a racket going around and around. And it's very profitable for this industry, but it's not profitable for you and I. You lose your health, you lose everything. And then in this debate, the idea of science is very, very important. All of them keep talking about science, that we are modernized agriculture because it's modern science. We're doing everything, we approve this chemical, but we are making science-based decisions. The whole idea of science has been done. Even the people who pollute the air, pollute the water, they use science. And of course, their supporters, they say, this is a science, this is modern science. So this cartoon is telling you that don't rush to that conclusion. You know, I mean, it says, trust me, but don't ask many questions in all these things. And some of the guilty parties feel guilty enough to pray to their divine being for forgiveness, and the companies again are having a wonderful time. In this instance, we have it says we have always had health in our minds, and you have Monsanto, Dow Chemical, and how's our stock? It says healthy. The stock is doing very well. And what are they talking about? Agent Orange. And what is Agent Orange? Two herbicides, 2,4-D and 2,4-5-T. They were both used in Vietnam War extensively. And they defoliated the jungles of Vietnam, and of course they destroyed a lot of rice crops. And what they said, you know, many of the Americans who were actually flying the airplanes, that they were doing the spraying or loading the chemical on the airplane and so on, they came down with diseases and eventually began to die from lymphomas of different kinds, cancer usually. And the government says no connection. You died, too bad, but it's no connection with these chemicals. And of course, the industry says, no, these chemicals are not carcinogenic. But something happened, however. There was a group of women in Oregon living in a very close to the National Forest. And the National Forest then used to spray 2,4-5-T and 2,4-D to kill the unwanted vegetation, they call it. And those women were trying to get pregnant. They couldn't get pregnant. Some of them got pregnant, but then they were having anencephalic babies, babies without brains, serious deforms and so on. So they wrote a letter to the administrator of EPA, and the administrator was good enough to send a team of scientists. This is late 70s, 1978. And they went to Alsea, Oregon. This is a small community where the letter came from. And they discover in a creek very close to the neighborhood that they found a molecule called DBCP, tetrachlorodibenzopyridoxin. And the moment they discovered that, they concluded, of course, they did the extensive study of wildlife as well as the fetus, fragments from the fetus and so on, that this tetradioxin actually was responsible for these serious deformities. And it was that study that eventually led EPA in 1983 to ban 2,4,5-T, that is half of the component of the Agent Orange. Therefore, the government had the evidence that this chemical was terrible. It's a contaminant of 2,4-D, 2,4,5-T. Nobody manufactures dioxin, but it's part of the process of creating the chemical. You have this byproduct. And but meanwhile, the Pentagon and Justice Department, they deny the veterans coming back from war that they had any problem, no compensation for them, despite the fact that EPA had already the knowledge that this was the reality. Eventually, of course, they had to accept it, because even the admiral, one of the admirals in the American Navy, whose name escapes me now, anyway, his own son died of cancer. His own son was in the war in Vietnam. And he eventually became a serious critic of the Pentagon and everything else that they were doing about this. And so this is just another footnote to the big picture I'm trying to paint. Here we have this is from a little magazine called Regeneration. You can see the connection. Things come out of the stack, they go to the water, and of course you have the fish, and we eat the fish, and so it's and here is a little example of something that happened to me. In 1988-89, EPA sent me to the university, to Humboldt State University in Northern California. So I taught there for a year. And I've been there, so I wrote this article about global warming, and it was published by the Chicago Tribune. Nothing happened. 6 months later, the Wall Street Journal picks up two paragraphs. from this essay, where I am very critical of the chemical industry, and I said, don't expect any kind of changes from the petroleum. They are going to continue to burn it to the end of time. And they published it by itself, and they put my name. So there was a congressional investigation. I mean, a senator from Montana wrote a letter to the EPA, says, who is this guy, Valley and others? Why is he writing like this? I thought he works for you. Is this what the EPA policy is about global warming? Remember, this is 1988, 89. 90. And so, no. So EPA immediately began to respond. He says, no. This guy writes on his own. He has nothing to do with us. He just happened to be teaching for a year and so on. But the moment the two paragraphs appear in the Wall Street Journal, that very day, and it happened to be an Earth Day, this is very symbolic, Earth Day 1990, I got a letter of reprimand on my desk. The very day that is. So that means my bosses were in touch with the Wall Street Journal. They knew exactly when the letter would appear, and they wrote the letter of reprimand. The letter of reprimand, of course, is in the federal government. It's the first step before they begin the process of kicking you out. Nothing happened to me because I knew the administrator, so I went straight to him. And he said, forget it. So he ordered his underlings to dismiss it and so on. But this is what happens. You're really taking a lot of risks when you're in the federal government. If you begin to leak and they discover, you're in deep trouble. These are some data from Louisiana. And you can see the state of Louisiana has a lot of firsts, all of them in pollution. So, okay, so we have its first poison surface water discharge, first in the country. Second in the commercial fish caught in the U.S. Second in the poisonous underground injections. They inject dozens of, I don't know how much, chemicals into very deep into the earth. Second in the importing of poisonous waste. Second in the overall discharge of poisons. Second in the discharge of carcinogens. Fourth in the poisonous air discharges. Fifth in the cancer death rate. Fifth in the worst resident general health quality, and so on. I just thought that this little table illustrates what's happening in the rest of the country, except New Orleans. I mean, and Louisiana in general it's a little bit severe. I taught also at the University of New Orleans in 1991, 1992. EPA sent me down there, and I taught. We had a laboratory in Mississippi. And during my teaching, I decided to take my students to see the so-called cancer corridor. This is the 100-mile-long between Baton Rouge, the capital, and New Orleans. So I went to the dean and I said, Dean, I need a couple of vans for the students, 30 students. He said, what do you plan to do with it? I said, I plan to take the students to go and look at the cancer corridor. We need to investigate to see so they're writing research papers and so on. He said, you're not going to do that with government, with university property. No way. Because if I allow you to take the cars, the industry will complain and they're going to say, you're biased. Think of it. I said, you're biased? I said, what? I said, what am I here for? I'm teaching the students, right? And so I don't want just to keep talking. I want them to see stuff. I want to see how pollution actually has been created. So he said, no. So, okay. So I went to the class and I said, students, this is the reason we're going to drive. So we got 5 cars and we drove and we did what we had to do. And so what I'm trying to say is that the government, the universities themselves are part of the problem. They get money from the industry, and therefore the professors have to be very careful in what they say to the students and what kind of research they do and so on. So it's not just the industry and EPA. It's many more facets of the American society involved. The political system is corrupt to allow this kind of behavior to go on. And when I say political system, I mean the universities, I mean all of us. This is just, let's wait and see if Rockler House keeps the company car. Rockler House has to be was the first administrator of EPA under President Richard Nixon. And President Richard Nixon, by the way, was the one who founded EPA in December 1970. And in the creation of the EPA and the speeches, and I don't know who wrote the speech, it's a fantastic kind of defense of the environment. And so I do have that respect for Mr. Nixon. This is 1970. Organophosphates, these are the chemicals I spoke about. These are the related to neurotoxins. And here is, again, another very funny cartoon about Mother Earth. And what we, one of the chemicals are one of the major exports of the U.S. Of this country. This is about EDB, ethylene dibromide. We eventually, EPA eventually banned it because it was a known carcinogen. And my friend Adrian Gross wrote a very detailed memorandum that this was a chemical carcinogen. And so here is union carbide on the right. On the left, on the right, and then on the left, you have this mother with the kids. A union carbide, by the way, was the company that we had the 1984 explosion in India with Bhopal. Some of you may remember the Bhopal destruction. That's the company. So you have better living through chemistry. Oh, gosh, what can you say? And this mother, this is a very, very interesting because, it's an extreme version, but nevertheless, you have this mother, her boy is ready to go outside, so he says, careful about fruits and apple juice. Avoid taking deep breaths outside. Think of that. Says Chilean fruit alar. In U.S., alar was not really a pesticide. It was simply they used it to keep the apples a few days longer standing on the tree. But it's toxic, and they eventually got rid of it. And here we have the beginnings of the genetic engineering in order to make the... I mean, in my humble opinion, the whole genetic engineering came into being in the 90s under the administration of Clinton in order to delay and to make more money out of the best-selling chemicals. Chemicals like 2,4-D, glyphosate, and so on. And they what they do in that process, they take the genes from one species, from fish, for instance, and they shoot it into another species, into corn. And they create a seed of corn or soybeans that can withstand the impact of spraying that chemical that we're dealing with, let's say glyphosate, but that chemical will kill everything else except the seed because it has been genetically engineered to withstand this kind of toxic contact. And, of course, this beautiful butterfly is threatened, just like honeybees are threatened. This is very much part of the California lifestyle, as they say here. Sure, I'm worried about the pesticides, but I have really gotten used to this mellow, laid-back California lifestyle. Look at the size of the insect. And this guy is dealing with a chemical known as DBCP, dibromochloropropane, that actually is toxic to any possibility of having children. Here, I'm afraid, the study shows that a number of our chemical workers have become sterile. Well, birth control is an extra. Duck it from their pay, the boss says. Chemical companies involved with genetic engineering. And this is another extreme version of a kind of abnormality, having a teratogen, a boy born with two heads. And they read in the newspapers, his officials say, cancer from chlordane. Chlordane is an organophosphate. I mean, organochlorine. It's related, it's like DDT kind of a substance. Says cancer from chlordane exposure is remote. And the other head says, come on. I want to read it too. Here is a very, very appropriate kind of cartoon because we are dealing with glyphosate, or the most popular chemical on Earth almost. Since, as you will see in the report, ladies and gentlemen, Monsanto deplores the use of pesticides, but we make one small exception, and that, of course, is the glyphosate. This came out of the British journal, The Ecologist. It's about genetic engineering, and this is a very, very important kind of slide that shows the conflict that's going on with agriculture, what we mean by agriculture. So this professor says, what does agriculture mean? And this young man says, it is 10% cultivation, 80% exploitation, and 10% agitation, which is pretty much the way it's going to this day. And of course, it takes an extreme version. Peasants are expelled from the land by pesticides, by tractors, by all sorts of other means. Bank loans, they can't pay back their loan, they lose their land. The land of the landowner becomes larger and larger, and therefore we have the picture I painted in the Central Valley here in California, or the Coachella Valley or the Imperial Valley, gigantic acres of land that we have recreated the medieval plantation. Really, that's what it is. And this transformation took place probably in the early part of this century from a solar agriculture relying on sunlight to a petroleum-based agriculture relying on just petroleum but gigantic machines and ignoring the natural world. And the result is, of course, gigantic farms that you need great machinery to do the harvesting, deploying. Look at this. The size of this farm must be hundreds and hundreds of acres. And this is, I took this picture in the Coachella Valley, Southern California. And this is also my picture from a small, relatively small animal farm in Central Valley. And the problem with this kind of thing is that not only you do violence against the animals themselves, look at how they tightly they're put together. So for them to not to die from disease, they give them antibiotics in their food. And you know, so if you love hamburgers, this is exactly what you're eating. You're eating cheeseburgers, plus you're eating antibiotics, plus you're eating all sorts of other chemicals, because they feed them contaminated. Yeah, oh, we're finishing. Okay, they're eating contaminated corn and soybeans and so on. Therefore, all of it gets into your soybean, into your food. Here's how they spray in a greenhouse. And the Zika virus was another scare, in which they said that the Zika virus causes all this microcephaly, but they forget the fact that this incidence comes in places where this extensive use of these neurotoxins and teratogens and so on. And this is a woman with her little beautiful little girl that has this defect. And in Brazil, of course, they use the military to enforce all that. Finally, this is my book. I hope I gave you a taste of what the book is all about. I trust that you will buy it and spread it to people you know. And with that, I thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you. We're listening to Mr. Valiantos on the EPA. Now we have time for questions, and I'll pass the microphone around.
Thank you, Doctor. Great talk. My question is about just sort of the consolidation that you're seeing in the industry, right? You had Monsanto, you had Dow. Monsanto just got bought earlier this year. Dow is now Dow DuPont. Do you find that they're getting more, would it be optimistic to think they're getting more responsible because of corporate social responsibility, or is the lobby getting stronger and a little more cutthroat?
It's the exact opposite. That is, they get more irresponsible. The more power you have, the less responsible you are for the public good. In fact, the idea of the public good disappears. So I think it's the governments who are completely irresponsible to allow this kind of mega growth to take place. I love small because the small brings you diversity, and it has a tradition of democracy, and it's beautiful for the environment. The food that comes out of the small farmer is not as dangerous, if at all it is dangerous, than the food that comes from the gigantic farms.
Yeah, well, so organic is good. Is that it? And, you know, because we have a lot of organic stuff here in California, right?
And I love organic food.
Every place, and not just here, I know. So yeah. I try to keep to that, you know, and stay away from that anyway, you know.
Yeah, organic food does not use any of these chemicals, does not use genetic engineering, does not use sludge, does not use radiation. So it's the only form of food that actually is good for us. And we should put our dollars where our mouth is, our health is. So therefore, I vote for the organic, and I urge all of you to stop eating conventional food. Conventional. I mean, the stuff that that we talked about. Conventional means that the farmer spray the field, spray everything.
So I grew up in Sacramento, and when I was in the 40s and 50s, we drive a couple hundred miles and stop at a service station. We have to wipe all the insects off the windshield. Now you can drive for hundreds of miles and not have any insects.
I mean, there's a lot of studies, scientific studies, that they show that the insects have been reduced by almost 70%. Without insects, you cannot have birds, right? And some of these insects, like honeybees, are terribly important because they do pollination of our crops. 30% of the crops come from bee pollination. So it's not a matter of just would like or dislike insects. It's a matter of ecological balance and health. If you have a terrible collapse of the ecosystem, then you are in deep, deep trouble, just like we are in deep trouble now with the global warming. And by the way, I forgot to say that conventional agriculture, that is the agriculture that uses chemicals, is responsible from between 20 and 40% of all the gases that go up into the atmosphere. Because of the gigantic animal farms that they have, all this poop and pee and all this stuff gives birth to what? Methane and other gases that go straight up. So this is why we are critical of that system of agriculture. We want to resurrect not only organic, but small-scale family farmers all over the country. That's what I would do.
Yes.
Take up all these big pieces of land and divide them into thousands and give opportunity to 1,000 small farmers to start farming again.
My concern is about the water. Even if you eat organic, you use the water, whatever water you have available. How do you get rid of the toxins in your home or water you purchase? How do you know electrolyted water? Is it safe? But the main concern for me is how do I filter out all the chemicals out of the water that comes out of your faucet?
I'm not a chemist. I don't know how to take them out of the water. What I want to do is to, and suggest, is to prevent this from happening. And you prevent this from happening by not spraying, by disallowing the spraying of neurotoxins.
That's right. It gets into the ocean.
Yeah, it kills fish and wipes out wildlife. It comes into your drinking water, as you say. It causes all sorts of diseases in children. I saw when in Washington, D.C. for 30 years ago, I saw a hospital devoted to cancer for children. I had never even imagined that there would be cancer would go to little children. God forbid.
Of course, water is the elixir of life for our life, our existence.
We cannot survive without water. And if we contaminate the various sources of the give us life, then we deserve to be extinct. I mean, this is completely irresponsible. I mean, it goes against the norms of Western civilization, it seems to me.
Okay, thank Mr. Vallinatos for his talk today. And we thank our audience here in the Commonwealth Club and those listening to this recording or seeing the film. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating 114 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Thank you.